Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Welcome to Everyday Americans on the BBC World Service. A chronicle following the opioid crisis with the Courier-Journal news organization in Louisville, Kentucky.
There's the papers coming out of the press.
The opioid crisis is crushing us.
It is now killing 30 Kentuckians every week.
We're an award-winning paper soon to celebrate our 150th anniversary with a team of journalists dedicated to covering addiction issues.
I'm making some coffee. That's like the first thing of the day. And then my day will be good. It just has to have coffee. I'm Beth Warren. I'm an enterprise and investigative reporter focusing on the addiction crisis. You'd be surprised that police and judges and prosecutors, people you think of in an adversarial role, have been very compassionate. Everybody's trying to figure out how to get us out of this crisis. Let's get our testosterone injected music on to set the tone for going and riding with the cops. The 9th Mobile Division, they target guns and drugs and gang members and often wrapped up in the same case. So they are targeting the hot spots where there have been recent shootings and violence, and they're hoping to get as much drugs as they can and illegal guns off the streets.
My name is William Hibbs, H-I-B-B-S. I'm the commander major of the 9th Mobile Division.
That was easy.
Every once in a while, when it gets a little bit tense around here, we got to slap the easy button and make it happen.
That was easy.
So here we are. In 2015, we seized 1.5 pounds of heroin. Now, that's a lot of weight when you're considering heroin as a, you know, this minute fact. When you, these people that are out buying a point or a gram, whatever you want to call it, in 2016, we seized 3.3 pounds of heroin. So we jumped almost 100% in a year. In 2017, we went to 15.7 pounds of heroin. So we're looking at a 418% increase in a year. And we don't do narcotic investigations. This is just consistent, proactive activity coming in contact with more and more and more of the same.
We have found the overdose victims in bathrooms at the gas station, bathrooms at the restaurants, sitting in the car. There's no place off limits for somebody who's using the narcotics.
And needles still in arms sometimes?
Oh, all the time, yeah. My name is Eric Velton. I'm a police officer with Louisville Metro Police.
He's the officer in charge of safety, health and safety. And his background as a paramedic is perfect for this role.
The way that the opioid works, it will just shut your respiratory system off. You don't take a big deep breath. Basically says, okay, body, you can stop breathing now.
So it's literally minutes from the time they hit the ground till they could be dead.
It absolutely could be, yeah.
Thankfully, officers had Narcan. And Narcan is a name brand of naloxone, which is the heroin and opioid antidote.
As a paramedic on the ambulance, I carried Narcan for years. the new device that we have, nasal Narcan. You pull it out of the pack, you put it in the nose, and you hit the button. Our newer officers who experience this for the first time, they go and actually administer Narcan, and they see the person start breathing on their own and wake up, and they're like, that person was dead a minute ago, and I just gave this medicine, and now they're awake.
Even
and
people who have turned blue, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
So do some cops find it bizarre that they're thrust in this role where they're lifesavers?
A lot do. Unfortunately, they are so used to it now because this is an everyday occurrence. They can guarantee just about every shift they come into work, they're going to make an overdose response.
All right, we'll get started. Everybody, welcome back. And it's our first Wild Wednesday back to noon. We love the schedule. Thursday, Friday's off is always nice. I always start the roll call by giving recognition from the night before. We went out and hit it pretty good for the two guns last night on the subject, working hard to dig, and the car was absolutely disgusting, but found additional marijuana in the first aid kit.
We're doing street operations today, and one of the areas that we're going to be going to initially here is that we've gotten some alerts to weapons firing in that area, along with violent criminal activity. This could include murders, robberies, assaults, and so forth. Obviously, those crimes associate with guns as well.
And gangs.
And gangs.
Opioid epidemics, man, I've been on for 29 years. And when I made Sergeant 97, you started to hear about Oxycontin, which is an opiate derivative. And then we went to Opana. It was being abused. Then heroin came in, and then things went nuts. This is probably around 2013, first part of it. And it, personal experiences, my younger brother died of a heroin addict. So, at the age of 35 years old, 2015. We had an officer had to be Narcan yesterday, exposed to fentanyl during the traffic stop to save him. We've had a couple to our canine dogs, when they're sniffing around for this stuff, they come upon loose fentanyl. We've had to use Narcan to revive the dogs.
Coming back clear in force on a gold 2006 Chrysler 300. Black female, 73181 at 2311 Bowling Ave. Guys, I am going to stop this Jeep once we get down Chestnut a little bit.
Our boss, Major Hibbs, he's going to... I initiate a traffic stop on a vehicle here in just about a minute or two, and we'll go down there and see what they get into.
Just in case they all split, there's four of them in the Jeep. That Tennessee tag is clear on an Enterprise rental.
Oh, rental car. No, okay. So they got themselves a rental car.
Occupied four times, got them for littering. Now we're in seatbelts right now. Got them stopped up here.
All right, going hot.
Hey, marijuana laid out in the middle of the car. We're going to search the vehicle. Traffic stop. Don't have a top on the car, and when they walked up to it, you can see the marijuana in plain sight sitting right there on the console. Didn't hide it very well.
Do you want a small plastic baggie for that?
Have you ever been arrested before, partner?
What's your name?
Relax.
Turn around. I want you to turn around.
No.
Listen to me. Listen. Hold on.
My social feed
all that. Just relax.
For real, sir.
It helps if you have an ID and you don't give an address that doesn't add up to your. How old you're telling us? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You got a gun?
No, I'm talking about a gun.
Yep. You got a handgun over there.
Are you up to speed on what's going on here? Detective Holman did a consent to search on this particular woman's purse, and when she opened it up and looked into the purse, the first thing that she saw was the narcotics here, which is probably going to be either methamphetamine or looks like methamphetamine, maybe a little bit of heroin over here, but then when she opened it up, she had a concealed firearm in her purse as well. So that's going to be a couple of charges there. Obviously, the felony possession of a controlled substance charge, and then the carry concealed deadly weapon.
1085 and a convicted felon and narcotics.
Okay, so where did the other gun come from?
Backpack in the back.
Okay, so they located another gun in the backpack in the back. So did we get somebody saying they're responsible for that by chance?
We haven't worked yet for you.
Okay.
So not their lucky day.
Okay, I want you to just take a couple minutes and look at what's going on here. As you can see, there are officers out here. Everybody's doing different tasks. There's one officer that's researching the criminal activity on the subjects that were in the car. We got other officers that are doing the searches of the car and the belongings. And then you have officers like me that are watching our suspects to make sure that they don't flee from the scene.
Shoot your shoulder bag.
No, that's too cheap for the belt.
You know that. See every bag. All right. It's got something in it, whether it's fake product from expensive designers, marijuana, handguns. They're convicted felons, should be having handguns to begin with. Because while we stopped them, they left one of our target areas, did a infraction as far as littering and not having seatbelts on, so made it pretty easy. We do this every day.
I'm Richard Green. I'm editor of the Louisville Courier Journal, couriergernal.com. I'm also the Midwest regional editor for the USA Today Network. It's been an interesting journey, but it seems like the one constant that has followed me around for the past 18 years has really been this notion of illegal opioids and this painkiller prescription crisis that is really gripping the country. I started to see it firsthand around 2001 when I was the local news editor in Cincinnati. Was when we first started getting reports of pill mills. We knew there was something different about this because it was the first time that we heard about the addiction to these painkillers. All of a sudden, the rampant abuse of painkillers coming from coal mining towns in eastern Kentucky, from the timber mills of eastern, southeastern Ohio, parts of coal mining and steel operations in western Pennsylvania, there was this bubbling up, if you will, of a brand new crisis that caught us off guard. And I think, as we look back at it, caught the entire country off guard. So I left and went to Southern California in Palm Springs in 2004. There you see the illicit and the illegal trade, particularly of heroin, that's coming from Mexico. And it became so intense that no matter how many times law enforcement would swoop in towns to take drug activity off the streets, it would grow quiet for a period of time, but they would keep coming back. And then you move to Iowa, and this was 6 years or so ago, and beautiful, great people, wonderful setting, rampant with the illegal drug trade. So the lessons for me was that there's not a place in this country that's safe from this epidemic. And it's a scary time.
Thank you. Do I hang on service for the
service? Three. I didn't see the one in the back.
That's kidding.
Whose car is this? His girlfriend? Who? The driver's girlfriend? Okay. Does he have a driver's license? He does? I mean, one of the things the law requires is that you carry your driver's license with you when you're operating a motor vehicle. All right? And you're an adult. You know, let's say there's a wreck. We don't know who you are. Everybody's unconscious. How do I get a hold of your mother and tell her where you're at? All right? You're an adult. How old are you? That's three times I've talked to you. Say, who, me? That's a bad sign. That's a bad sign, all right? All right, you say, who, me, who, me? I'm looking if there's an owl around here, because all you're saying is who. All right? You ever been arrested before?
Yes, sir.
That's the fourth time you said, who, me. I'm talking to you, nobody else right now. Not anybody over here, man, who, me, okay? You ever been arrested before?
Yes, sir.
What did they say you did? You got a dope case pending. Who, me, you? Yeah, you. Yeah. Man, I appreciate you helping us out. Who's got the keys?
After we stopped the subjects and processed the scene, we discovered that they have active warrants for their arrest. So basically what we've done, we've brought them down here to the facilities, Louisville Metro Corrections. This is where they're housed temporarily, either, you know, released, short-term sentencing. Then from here, if it's beyond a year, they'll send them on to the state penitentiary. So these guys, this guy in particular, he's got three active warrants for his arrest, two of which are within this county.
It's Friday, September 7th. My name is Justin Sayers, and I'm a reporter with the Courier-Journal. We're standing outside the Louisville jail, which has been overrun with inmates due to the opioid epidemic in the region. We're going to go inside and find out what they're doing to combat that.
I am Mark Bolton, director of the Louisville Metro Department of Corrections, which is the local jail system in Jefferson County, Louisville, Kentucky. We are in the main jail complex, one of four facilities that we operate. In most communities that are struggling with this opioid epidemic, jails end up being really kind of ground zero. And so what we ended up doing here is we adopted a community detox model. Okay, and you guys will get to see that model at work. And what I can tell you, when we first started doing this in 2012, we detoxed about 2,900 people out of 33,000 bookings. In 2017, we detoxed almost 10,000 people. And out of those 10,000 detoxes, almost 6,000 of those were opioid detox. We are the largest detox withdrawal program in the region, as well as the largest mental health facility as well.
There you go. My name is Ken Wright, and I'm the Substance Abuse Program Coordinator for Louisville Metro Department of Corrections in Louisville, Kentucky. We're actually about to go into one of the treatment detox dorms. There's four different programs. We want to have one female program, and we have three male programs.
A-side Alpha. Male in the dorm, is everybody decent, half dressed?
Okay. Come on in. We're actually coming into the treatment detox dorm, and the ladies that are sitting up here, these are the ladies that are actually in the treatment part of the program. It's a 90-day program. Some of the ladies that you see laying on the floor are detoxing, and so they're laying around, and they're physically sick, and fluids, unfortunately, are coming out of every part of them, not because they want to, just because that's the nature of it. They're not bad people trying to get good. They're sick with an illness trying to get better. And the sooner that the community realizes that, then we can help these folk. Nobody, I think, woke up one day and says, hey, you know what? I think I want to be in jail. You think that they just want to be away from their children? How heartbreaking that is.
I started doing heroin, and as a result of that, I became homeless. And I felt that was okay. I lost my car, lost my job. I was victim of a violent sexual assault because of my actions of where I placed myself in dangerous situations and places I shouldn't have been. It stripped me of everything.
I have five kids. My oldest is 21 and my youngest is 10 months old. I remember having to get well before I could get my kids up for school. And if I didn't get well by using, they might miss school or they might have a tardy record of missing 6 days that month, and then you got a truant officer at the door trying to figure out why your kids are not coming to school on time and trying to get doctor's excuses and all these things to rectify their situation, but it's really because of my situation.
I've got custody of my kids, and I've had custody of them, but I haven't really physically been there for them for the past 4 years. Yes, I was there, like they could see me, but I was not physically there. I was always high, and if I wasn't high, I was running out to get the dope. They would see me leave more than they would see me come. I've been in and out of jail since 2012. My little girl's 8, and it doesn't even faze her when I go. My boys, it does. They know it fazes them, but I really didn't raise her. Her aunt and her dad has raised her.
Yo,
God, grant us the serenity.
Right's coming out.
To accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference just for today. Thanks, ladies. Shooting stars. Woo!
Sometimes it seems real quiet, but really, underneath the surface, there's a hell of a lot going on. I'm Joel Christopher. I'm the executive editor at the Courier Journal.
When you step into this part of the building, it's like walking into the past, really. I mean, the noises and the smells that you have in this room, you know, you hear that machinery clacking, you got that smell of ink and paper. I mean, that's the smell of freedom, right?
How are you?
Doing good.
What's going on?
Don, these gentlemen are from the BBC. They're spending a lot of time, many weeks with us, reporting on the opioid crisis through the lens of our reporting.
Yeah, I lost my niece to heroin.
Oh, really?
You did?
I didn't know that. A number of years ago. Yeah, a little 22 years old, looked like a little cheerleader. I mean, parents did everything they could possibly do. They just couldn't beat it.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't, so...
We're going to go see Russell Coleman, who used to be an FBI agent. Now he's the top federal prosecutor for the western half of Kentucky.
Russell Coleman was brought in about a year ago, and his focus is to aggressively tackle guns and gangs and drugs. And he put together like a task force that has U.S. agents from various law enforcement agencies, and they work with local police to identify the main players that cause a lot of the violence and crime in our city. And they're trying to get them really hefty prison sentences, like 20 years to life. Mr. Coleman, last night the BBC and I were with the 9th Mobile Division, and within one night they basically made, I believe it's 12 arrests, 8 guns, 1 on a juvenile, and 2 were stolen. And then they also recovered some crystal meth, cocaine, heroin, pot. That's kind of a lot for just one day, but they say that's pretty normal. I'm sure you're probably not surprised to hear that.
Unfortunately not. What you are exposed to is the infrastructure of violence in this community in Louisville, Kentucky. That is guns, drugs, and gangs. But that is what is driving so much of the violence, so much of the poison, so much of the agony that this community is facing over the last few years. Last year, in 2017, we had, in this city, we had 426 people die to drug-related death, drug overdose. Now, it's one thing to talk about a number of 426 when we're sitting at this polished conference table with the maps on the walls and the seal of the Department of Justice on the wall. But that's 426 families where there's an empty chair at that table. And that is 426 churches without a congregant and 426 businesses without someone showing up that day. That's catastrophic. In our state, 1,565 last year in a small state, southern, some would say midwestern state like Kentucky, 1,565. And we know that number probably isn't accurate. We know that it's much higher than that. Because of the way we classify death, it's probably higher than that. That is catastrophic. And it demands a D-Day-like response. And we're not there yet.
This is Matt Glowicki, criminal justice reporter with the Courier Journal. It's Friday, the 7th of September. And we're here in the district court in Louisville. Courtroom 101, you've got 9 a.m. here and well over a dozen cases. And you have things for cases such as cocaine trafficking, license to be in possession of a handgun, someone owned a gun and shouldn't have, probably they're a felon. Here you have someone trafficking carfentanil or fentanyl. So obviously, those are the much more potent versions of heroin, you know, carfentanil being the elephant tranquilizer. You don't see that too often, so that's obviously a serious case. Trafficking of methamphetamine, drug paraphernalia. Maybe they had a needle or a bong or something on them that, you know, they shouldn't have had. Then that's just one courtroom in just one scheduled hour, 9 a.m. I mean, that's duplicated in about a dozen courtrooms in this building. And then across the street is the circuit court. And circuit court handles felony cases, so much more serious criminal syndicate cases. Now, if your case is appropriate for drug court, you'll go to a separate courtroom before the drug court judge and begin those proceedings. Because it's voluntary, though. You can't be forced into drug court.
We have some individuals who are early on in the program, and then we have some individuals who are in aftercare who are close to completion of the program.
I'm Judge Stephanie Pierce Burke. I am a drug court judge, and in this court, we hold hearings on all type of mental health issues and addiction issues. So when someone is charged with a crime, and they come to court, and they're identified as someone who is an addict, they may be given the opportunity to be assessed for drug court. We'll talk with them and do an assessment, asking them a wealth of questions, and find out what their background is and kind of where they are in their addiction. And they will look at their risk factors and their needs and determine if they are an appropriate candidate. And if they are, then they will offer, as part of the resolution of their criminal charge, to get either a lesser offense, meaning sometimes they'll amend a felony down to a misdemeanor, or as a diversion agreement where they would, if they complete the program at the end, they would set the conviction aside, or they just end up getting a lesser sentence, or they just stay out of jail and don't go to jail, they go to the program instead. You want to bring him in? Yeah, you bring him in. Yeah, let's sit up here. So the individuals who are in custody come in and participate, and they all sit in here during the whole docket, and they'll listen to the docket, but they'll be in the box up here. Come in, have a seat. How are you?
Good, how are you?
All right, Summer is in phase two of the program.
How's your relationships, friends, support network?
That's really good. I'm getting to see my kids again, all three of them. I didn't even think, you know, a year ago, I was a dead soul walking around. I couldn't even stay alive. I would tell my mom, like, tell them I love them, like I died trying. You know what I'm saying? Like, I did not see any of this coming a year later. So I'm just, sometimes I just sit back and just can't even believe when I have all three of my babies in a room together. Like, I'm not where I want to be with them, don't get me wrong, far from it, but just to have them in my life at all is huge, because I didn't even see my oldest two. If I want to be honest, I don't even tell people for about 2 years. The last time I left my son, he was waiting at the window for me. You know what I'm saying? And I never showed up because I overdosed.
They want hugs.
Yeah.
Good for you. I'll see you on the 24th.
Yes, ma'am.
And at graduation.
I know. I'm so excited. Okay.
Thank you. Stephanie, what's new?
Nothing much. I got a raise at work.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's amazing.
How's the baby?
He's doing great. I took him to the doctor Friday.
How old is he now?
4 months.
Anything wrong? Any problems? Anything? Stress?
They've been killing me at work a lot, like 13, 14 hours a day.
Working too much?
Yeah. So I told him, I said, I've got to cut back a little bit. Like, the only time I see Jordan is to put him to sleep and on the weekends, and I'm not okay with that.
Proud of you.
Thank you.
Keep it up.
Yes, ma'am.
Marissa? How is it?
It's great. You know, as long as I was out there in that kind of madness, I didn't really want to quit, you know, and I'll be honest with you, like, I feel like I found more freedom in the last 2 months that I've been here.
In jail.
Than I ever did on the outside. Because I don't have that addiction anymore. So, and I don't ever want it again. No. Making changes.
Good changes.
I'll see you October 1st.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Ashley?
I'm good.
How are you feeling?
Tired.
Yeah? How many weeks are we?
I'll be 36 Thursday.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's your plan?
I would like to stay where I'm at.
So she's asking to stay in the halfway house when she has the baby. Well, just take care of yourself.
Okay.
I'm going to see you on the 24th.
Okay.
Alex. So you got your job back?
I do. I have my job back.
Great.
It is good news.
How are things?
Things are going pretty well. My car broke down again today.
Again. You able to manage it?
Yeah, I'm going to be able to manage it. I'm not taking it to the same douchebags who were dealing with it before, but I'm really frustrated by this car. I know. You're right. I'll take a look at it.
What's your clean date?
August 20th.
And how do you feel?
I feel pretty good right now. I feel like stuff's starting to come back around for me.
You coming to graduation?
Yeah, I'm rushing out to deal with my car. I'm assuming I'll be able to get this dealt with. But yes, I will be at graduation.
Good.
I'm at Cave Hill Cemetery. We've come here to meet Linda Squire.
It's a long story and a sad story, but in a lot of ways, we celebrate Johnny's life because we know that that's what he would want. But, you know, we also have to talk about the things that led us here, which happened to many of his friends and other people that, you know, I meet day to day. He started using drugs when he was kind of 15 and then continued to use what was pot, and then it was pills, and then the opioids, and then eventually the heroin. And so we didn't know about the fentanyl. This was January of 2015, and nobody knew very much about the fentanyl.
Right, the fentanyl, the synthetic that is hidden in heroin and without the user's knowledge a lot of times, and it's so much more deadly.
Right, and so we knew that Jonathan was using. He had been in rehab several times.
And I'm sure if I went to pick up my dry cleaning at where he was at, I would never have known he was suffering from addiction.
Exactly, right. Well, 2 days before, as a family, we all went out to dinner to celebrate my daughter Alexandra's birthday. And he all walks in like, you know, here I am, I'm gorgeous or whatever, you know. I noticed he seemed a little agitated. And his dad noticed that when he was putting his jacket up on the hanger hook, he kind of missed it a little bit, you know. And so John was worried, and I was too, but Mom, I'm fine. I got this under control and all that. And we took a photo of the three of them, before we left. And we didn't hear from him on Saturday. He was supposed to come over and pick something up. He didn't. Sunday, I was supposed to meet him, you know, to do something with his car. And I didn't hear from him that night. And then I started to get a little bit worried. I called his apartment the next day. I went over there with his sister. And I saw his car parked outside. And I said, something's wrong. And I had the key. And so I went in and the apartment was beautiful. The cats were sort of roaming. I went into his bedroom, and he wasn't there. And I went into the bathroom, and there he was, lying face down on the floor. And the shock, the numbing that happens at that minute. John was in Canada.
Your husband, yeah.
My husband, John, right, had to get home on 2 planes. And I had to figure out what to do. Where do we bury him? What funeral parlor do we go to? What do we do? So I said, well, John came home. Let's take a ride to Cave Hill, you know, and check everything out here.
It's the prettiest cemetery I've ever seen, honestly. It's rolling hills. It's beautiful lakes. And Muhammad Ali is buried here. And Colonel Sanders, the founder of KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, is buried here. And a lot of founding fathers of Louisville who are buried here. And Johnny was someone who loved nature, so this seemed like a good fit, right?
Right, it did. And when we saw this chapel area, John said, I think he belongs here.
Today is September 12th, 2018. It is 8:48 p.m. in the evening. We are heading out to do home visits. I'm Officer Shane Justice. I am the Louisville Metro Police liaison to the Jefferson County Drug Court.
I'm Judge Stephanie Burke, and I'm the drug court judge. I'm with Officer Justice this evening to go out on the home visits. I randomly go on the home visits with him, and we go out to visit the clients and see their living situation. It's helped for me to know where they live and sometimes meet their families and get a better picture of who they are and what their conditions are. We'll get to have talks with them that are kind of open things up to for them to have more of a kind of a personal bond with us when we're in their homes. And that openness and that honesty is how we're successful. It's very overwhelming at times when you think about the numbers of how many people you're dealing with at a time coming in daily. And you may see 10, 20 people a day that you know are dealing with this type of addiction. And that's only the people that end up in the court. Think of how many there are that don't end up here. Those numbers are really large.
Hi.
How you doing?
How are you?
Can
you sit up?
Yeah, absolutely.
So when was the last time you used?
20 months ago.
How has your sobriety changed your relationship with your family? I know the answer to these questions.
Right. Now I'm not a burden. I carry them now. You know, I can carry them on my back instead of them having to carry me. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing.
When you were using, who was caring for your children?
My mother and my father.
Mm-hmm. Who cares for them now?
Me. Mm-hmm. Me and my girlfriend.
Okay. Well, we gotta move on. Bye.
So we try to learn what are the triggers for the individual. What are the things that that individual struggles with? And what areas do we want that individual not to be in? And we learn who are the people that are not good for them to be around, who are the people that they used to use with, or who kind of can lure them back into misbehaving.
And that's why halfway houses are so great. It gives them a chance to build a support group with other people who are also in recovery. They have similar experiences, and they have that structure and support so they can be successful.
Okay, so this is our living room, and we come down here to do morning meditation. We also do classes here twice a week on Tuesdays and also Thursdays. And also over here, we got this board over here, which tells everybody, like, this one through, okay, this over here. I love doing this. Okay, so these are all the people, all the residents here, and these are all our sponsors. And these are people's sobriety dates and, you know, people on probation or parole. Here's the number and the number of meetings people, you know what I'm saying?
NA
or AA. And everybody here has a curfew. We have to be in by 10 o'clock at night. And these are everybody's phone numbers. then we know exactly where they're at, you know?
I will say this, and I stand by this, that I do not believe I would be alive today if it was not for drug work. I will internally be grateful for
all
of it.
All at once?
Yeah. Okay.
Bye. Nice to meet you. Bye. Bye, guys. Bye. Y'all have a good day.
I had two girls die over the weekend that we had, so it's not an easy job. One was a graduate, and one was a girl who'd been, you know, struggling, and there's now four young children without their mothers.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you? Well, surprise.
Yeah. Good to see you. Yeah, welcome to Grace's house. Alex is right here. Just moi. What do y'all want to know?
Just wanted to visit you.
Well, this
see
is...
See how you're doing.
Yeah, this is the downstairs. You know, typical halfway house life. The microwave's on the fritz. But it's getting fixed, you know. This time last year, actually, I got locked up September 4th this time last year, and I was, this time last year, I was going through the detoxes of, you know, epic proportion. It was horrible. For me, I had to be drugged to jail and forced into a corner. You know, I was successful. I played college basketball, graduated high school, went to college, played ball, had good people around me, but the addiction is so... It's so complex. I mean, it's mind, it's body, it's the cravings, and especially with heroin. And I'm just, a lot of people that are clean, they don't like you to speak the name of the drug. It upsets some people. It brings up a lot of emotion. It brings up a lot of, you know, I mean, because there's such a direct tie between drugs and that specific drug, just the name of the drug. That's how deep it's embedded into you once you are addicted to it. I mean, just the name of it can bring up rapid heartbeat, you know, the turning of the stomach.
Today is Wednesday, September 19th. It's 7:57. We're about to start the morning news meeting. This is Rachel Ertekis, the breaking news editor.
Hey guys, I'm sorry I'm late. I'm headed to Starlight for a fried chicken breakfast.
Get some white gravy with that.
Good stuff. What else?
We're waiting for the ID of that one-year-old who was killed last night in the driveway after getting hit by a car. Glowicki had that late last night, and so we just have the information.
I'm Philip M. Bailey, and I'm the political reporter here at the Courier-Journal. I'm a child of the 80s. I was born in 1984. And I remember the Just Say No movement, you know, the Reagan era, and I was taught, both at home and in the school system and from those public service announcements, that drug addicts were just as much a part of the problem as drug dealers, right? There was a demonization of drug abusers. With this current crisis, with the opioid crisis, more and more of your users and abusers of the drugs are white. And now it's not seen as a criminal issue. It's seen as a health issue. It's not a matter where we just lock these people up and throw them away for 20, 30 years. We need to get them into treatment. And that shifted in large part parallel to the shift in the demographics of the people who are being affected by the drug. It went from urban America, black America, you know, Hispanic America. And now it shifted from your urban areas into your suburbs, into your rural parts of the country. So with that, there's a lot more bipartisan agreement. Republicans and Democrats agree that we need to do something about the opioid crisis from a public health standpoint, that there needs to be a compassionate, sympathetic arm to these policies that deal with people who have these addictions. And that's certainly different than how it was treated 20, 30 years ago. So that's been, to me, the most interesting political change and switchover, is that now, and you see it even in the media, the stories are far more sympathetic. It's told from a sense of almost that they can't help themselves when, like I said, back in the 70s and 80s, it was, no, you have a moral failing, and that's why you're addicted to these drugs, and you need to be held responsible for that. For the most part, that's not the mantra anymore.
Good evening. I am David Mike. I'm the Urban Program Supervisor for the Jefferson County Drug Court, and it's my honor and privilege here to spearhead the graduation this evening. So thank you for being here, all the family and friends, and most importantly, graduates.
This is Matt Glowicki, criminal justice reporter here at the Courier-Journal. Defendants in drug court remain under the court's jurisdiction for 18 to 24 months, but sometimes even longer if necessary. Those who complete this rigorous, intense program of recovery get recognized in a formal graduation ceremony held in the Mayor's Gallery, which is in our historic courthouse downtown.
At this time, I am going to ask for Judge Burke if she would come up and introduce our guest speakers.
Pat Younger was born and raised in Louisville. He married Mary Dawn Younger and has been married for 29 years, and they have two children, Catherine and Michael. He's been sober since 1984, and many of you might know him from working out his work out in the recovery community. Pat Younger.
Not only am I a person in recovery, but my daughter has struggled with her addiction as well for the last several years, and I know that some of you guys know her. She's in a good place today, so I'm happy to report that to you. I'm a songwriter, and it's funny. This is probably different than any drug court graduation ever because we've got the BBC here, right? So if this would be broadcast maybe across the world, I don't know. But I'm going to play this song, and this song's called 60 Days. And I wrote this song when Catherine was in drug court, and she had 60 days of sobriety. And I think it was one of the first times she ever had 60 days. So I'm going to play this for you. And even though most of you are probably a year or longer sober, listen to the words, because the words are for you today, okay? Nothing less than a miracle. It looks good on you.
If you are like me, you've been in the gutter. But there in the gutter, a rose, and there's a flower that can grow in the gutter. So keep on pushing, enjoy the ride, and don't let the counselors get on your nerves.
Hope's on the rise.
I'm Kelly, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. My sobriety date is May 30th of 2017, and today I made a deep and personal commitment to stay clean and sober. That's for today.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. I come in with a whole lot of issues. Like, my stuff was so outlandish, they really thought I was lying at first. And drug court did a whole lot of stuff that they didn't have to take the time out of their day to do to help me. And I owe them everything and my life.
It looks good on you.
Today I have sole custody of both of my kids. Full-time job that I hold, guarding a pharmacy. that's real big for me. I'm trusted today, and integrity is real, real big with me. So I just want to thank everybody, each and every one of you, for being here and supporting somebody like me. That's all I got.
It looks good on you. Promises come true. Just remember, we're always here for you. Always here. Always here. For you. For you. For you.
Thank you. Congrats.
Everyday Americans was produced by Neil Rizel, Mark Savage, and Phil Reivel. The editor was Emma Rippon. Next week, the series continues, following reporters from the Courier-Journal into schools and hospitals as they cover efforts to prevent the opioid epidemic from spreading.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.